Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Sport Pods.
Hi, welcome to Michael Calvin's Football People. I'm joined from Qatar by Jonathan Northcroft of the Sunday Times and by Paul Hayward, who's literally written the book on the England national team. This World Cup is now entering the knockout phase. That's where more games than ever are won in the mind. I've been speaking to leading sports psychologist Tom Young. He's a big admirer of Gareth Southgate's people-driven approach. Now, this might sound strange given what he's already achieved, and with a last 16 game against Senegal to look forward to. But Paul, is it about time Southgate was given more credit?
I think that point arrived several years ago, Mike. Again, some people are lurching between opinions on Gareth Southgate. In the first game, everybody was raving about this attacking verve that saw off Iran with a 6-2 win. In the USA game, everybody complained that the handbrake was back on and that Southgate's conservatism was killing England. And then in the second half of the Wales game, everybody was enthusing again about the range of match-winning, game-changing players at his disposal. All the way through in group stages, he's adopted a balanced approach, tried to make the best use of his resources and strategized the group stage. That's very much part of his thinking. But he does live in this environment where people jump between extreme verdicts. And I think he's probably used to it now. But, you know, that's the way it is.
What's the view on the ground like, Johnny? You know, I noticed that Gareth's talking about a different mentality within his group than, say, you know, that he had in Russia, perhaps more belief. With all this going on, is one of Southgate's greatest assets his ability just to fade out the noise?
I think so. I think creating a happy bubble for the England squad has been one of his biggest achievements. And it gets underplayed sometimes because I think we're in a world where people evaluate coaches very much on the tactical side of things, on that horrible word philosophy. And of course, that tastes are formed by the leading coaches of the age, like Guardiola, who's everything. But because of that, I think there's an undervaluing of the older skills, the softer skills, which would be, you know, creating cultures, groups of players who've got a common cause and a focus, a purpose. And Gareth has been incredibly good at doing that. And you see on the ground here, the thing that really struck me speaking to him in the aftermath of the USA game was how even he was, how reflective but positive he was, and how he was taking the opportunity to try and as Paul outlined very well, Gareth's been in this job for a while now and he knows the lurches of opinions. And he was very conscious after that USA game, knowing what was coming, knowing the backlash, to try and realign people and just make everyone feel put a bit of perspective, more positive perspective on the performance. Now, the contrast was after the Iran game, where when everyone was getting overexcited, he was trying to temper that excitement. And I think he very consciously tries to bring an evenness, not just to his own work, but to the players around him and maybe as far as he can to us as a media. It's not always going to work. There's always going to be those lurches from some colleagues perhaps, but he does his bit to try and keep us on this kind of even keel with perspective.
Yeah, we all know, don't we, chaps, that managers or head coaches are judged by the difficult decisions that they make. What do you think the key decisions are that Southgate has to make on Sunday for the Senegal game Paul. You know, obviously there's going to be a focus on whether he retains Foden or Rashford or and Rashford.
Yeah, it's a very different game to the Wales one. We know that. I think the problem he has, or the conundrum I should say he has, is that the changes he made against Wales were framed very cleverly as people being rested, but actually by a remarkable coincidence, the players who hadn't played well in the previous game were left out. Saka, Sterling and Mount were below par in that game and didn't play against Wales. The players who came in performed extremely well. And so that it's that classic manager's problem of thinking, do I keep these guys who delivered for me in the team, or do I go back to my original starting 11? If it were me, I certainly wouldn't drop Rashford because of the confidence he's playing with. And I certainly wouldn't drop Foden. I think I would go without Saka and Sterling, and I would have Rashford and Foden still in there.
When we think about Rashford, Johnny, we think about the power of redemption, don't we? Is his progress in Qatar another example of Southgate's understated leadership?
I think it is. I think if you look at the pictures, the footage when England finish games, you'll see Gareth going over to Rashford a lot and trying to reinforce, you know, on that one-to-one personal level, his kind of trust in him. He's obviously put a lot of work into that personal relationship. And I think we've got to be aware that Rashford hadn't played a single minute for England after missing that penalty in the Euros final. And sometimes when you've got a player that's been out of the picture for that long and you try and bring them back into a squad, there are difficulties. And I think it says a lot about Gareth's management that he's been able to bring him straight in. He's been able to get the right Marcus Rashford mentally, and he's been able to integrate very happily into the squad. And that's another testament to his management skills. And, you know, as Paul said, it's about picking players who are in that hot moment. And nobody's in a better moment, really, for England, arguably Harry Maguire, than Rashford, who in the last two games, even as a substitute when he came on against Iran, he has been that point of danger in all those matches. And I think he has. You have to keep riding that. You have to keep going with that in this next game against Senegal.
Yeah, Johnny mentioned Harry Maguire there, Paul. It is marked how much better a player, perhaps how much more confident he is as a person playing for England rather than Manchester United. What's the rationale behind that, do you think?
Well, cricketers are giving up red ball for white ball, so maybe Harry Maguire could give up club football for international football and get a central contract from the FA. That would be my answer to that, Mike, because the difference between his performances for club and country are vast, you know. Usually, it used to be the other way around, didn't it? Club players underperform for the country. He's reversed that equation. He does seem comfortable in the England setup. He makes fewer mistakes. He plays with more authority and confidence. But, you know, it's for Erik ten Hag, really, that his job now is, when he gets him back to Manchester United, to say to him, look, OK, we have to close this gap. You have to play for Manchester United the way you play for England, and I need to help you find a way of achieving that.
Yeah, I'm thinking here of basketball, actually, Johnny, but the concept of an athlete known as a glue guy. In other words, there's that individual whose contribution or his value is greater than his contribution on the pitch, or as in basketball, on the court. I'm thinking of Jordan Henderson in that type of category. And it's been very marked that he's almost, I don't know whether he's been asked to do this, but he is gravitating towards Jude Bellingham quite a lot, I've noticed.
Yeah, I mean, the Scouse Twitter is alive with the fact that both Hendo and Trent Alexander-Arnold seem to be spending a lot of time with Jude Bellingham at a time that Liverpool sort of covet his services. And I don't think that's the reason he's doing it. I think he is doing the team thing very much. And he's one of those, you know, he is a glue guy for England. He's got, I think, his person in a squad full of kind of nice blokes, he's got a different edge to his personality. He's a lovely bloke, Jordan, but he's very competitive on the pitch and very vocal. And that's something different to most of the England players. And I think it's very valuable. I wrote about this at the weekend, that there is a flaw in this team in that it can settle into a kind of passive mode of playing sometimes, where no matter what Gareth told them, they can fall into a difficult patch in the game. And I don't think there are many with those kind of personalities that will drag other players out of it. But Jordan Henderson does. He looks to affect people around him. And I love the thing he said when he was asked about, he did an interview to publicise his book. And he said, you know, I should have called it With or Without Me, because Liverpool would have won all that stuff with or without me. And I think that says everything about his team-orientated and self-deprecating nature.
Yeah, well, kudos to Ollie Holt, our long-term colleague, for coming up with that, I suspect, but there we are. let's just briefly wave goodbye to Wales, if we could, Paul. I found, actually, that the sight of Wales in retreat, as it were, quite touching, especially Gareth Bale. Is it time, do you think, for him to actually just fade away gracefully?
Well, he played as if that's the course he's on, regardless of what he wants to do. So the decision could be made for him. He's very powerful in Welsh football, and I suppose any time the manager thought he could get even a spark out of him in a qualifying campaign, he'd probably take that gamble. But yeah, with Wales, I was really disappointed with them. They were living off the romance of having qualified for the first time in 64 years, but that didn't seem any use to them when the games actually started. And it was surprising to me that they couldn't even summon the kind of underdog spirit that you would expect from them. There wasn't that tenacity and application and togetherness you would have expected. I can see why they were outplayed by certain teams, because they're one of the lowest ranked teams in the tournament, whatever their FIFA ranking says. But they just didn't turn up, and that was a great surprise to me.
Yeah, sure. Perhaps sometimes these things are in the mind. I first met Tom Young when he was working with the European Ryder Cup team. He operates across sports, from rugby league to football. Now, with pressure ratcheting up at the World Cup, I thought it was time to catch up with him once more. Well, Tom, thanks for joining us. You know probably better than anyone that sport is largely played in the mind. We've got the World Cup. Now, how do you prepare a footballer or a team or a management group for the ultimate exposure that the World Cup provides?
That's a really good question. That's a big question as well. I think the key thing is that it starts way before the World Cup, you know, and that's on an individual level, that's on a group level. It's like if you're practicing your tactics or working on tactics, you don't wait until the eve of the World Cup to start preparing for it. So I think crucially, the best teams and the most kind of organized high performance environments will have been preparing for this over the last 2 years, 4 years, however you view that cycle, and over the experience that they've gathered during that time period. So first of all, I think it starts ahead, and it's about being proactive with this kind of stuff. It's not reacting, waiting for there to be a problem and then working on something in some kind of panicked way. So you could look at things like a collective. So high performance teams, you would always say they have an underpinning, a kind of grounding in trust. So to do that, they have to have a common purpose. They have to have a clear idea of what they stand for, what their beliefs are, how they're going to play as well, who they are as individuals. And I think that's really important. So you think about examples of teams coming together, teams knowing that they can back each other and look to that person next to them, and they can, you know, they're going to perform in those moments, or they're going to have each other's backs. That starts way before. That's about delivering that collective, that identity that we build. So if you think about teams, I don't know, think about some examples. Gareth Southgate talked about connecting with the fans. They've talked about belonging and a kind of sense of tribalism, I think, within the England camp, and almost challenging some of the things that went before, some of the baggage they might have held before. So I think there's a collective team environment that you've got to start to build, and that's done really so far before the tournament would begin. And then management teams, again, they've got to know what they stand for. They've got to be authentic. They've got to be resilient as they're going through those tournaments. And again, if we're looking at England, you would argue over the last couple of tournaments, they've started to gather that experience, positive and negative, in terms of they've had a whole range of sporting experiences and emotions and outcomes that they've been able to deal with and come back from as well. And then individuals, I think the role of a psychologist there is it's about helping each individual probably prepares in their own way. So it's not about taking a blanket approach. It's about understanding the personalities within the group, what they need, and being able to help them get to the point where they're in that optimal kind of zone in order to perform. And that might be little triggers. That might be having a word with them in camp. That might be helping them to identify unhelpful thoughts and things like that. It's not about ignoring emotion or ignoring thoughts. It's about tackling those head on and being willing to talk about them and in a proactive way, I would say.
Mm. With management teams, you know, you worked with Belgium and Roberto Martinez. In specific terms, like all coaches that I know, the best coaches are all self-educators anyway. Mm. What do they take from you in the way that, they want to do their job?
I think you're right. They're all self-educated. That's one of the... So I did a lot of research with head coaches as well. And I think one of the things they do now, and you see that, I read something about Arteta learning from Eddie Jones recently and things like that. There seems to be this open and sharing of information from different sports. Maybe it's less threat.
I'm gonna show off now, oh, Tom. That was on this podcast.
Ah, right, okay.
It was my interview.
There you go. So that's obviously gone into my brain somewhere to see that. But there's a whole host of that learning from different environments. And I think Gareth's done that with England by the sound of it in terms of having visitors into camp. So they definitely draw information from different environments, probably more than people in their own environments as well, because of that, I suppose, a little bit more open and vulnerable in order to do that. I think the relationship with a psychologist and a head coach can be very different depending on who you're working with. So those head coaches might have mentors, they might have people they turn to, they might have family members, because it can be quite a lonely existence, I would say, especially in tournaments. Like, even though you're around loads of people, you're often detached from it in a way, because the pressure is on you as well. So I think sometimes it's just a sounding board. I think that's the main thing. It's about spotting key messages that they may be giving and maybe slipping back into, you know, I talk about autopilot. We like to run on autopilot. Our brains are lazy. So we slip back into patterns of thinking or patterns of behavior that we've kind of carried with us throughout our lives. And sometimes that can be unhelpful. Sometimes we can go down an irrational way. Sometimes we can maybe try something, I suppose, with a manager. A good example would be almost thinking, oh, what do we need to do? It's the semi-final or it's the quarter-final. We need to do something to motivate the players, or we need to change something. And actually the best thing to do in most occasions is to keep things as much the same as they can, while knowing that it's a semi-final of a World Cup, to keep things as normal as possible. And sometimes our tendency or our desire is to go, come on, let's do something different. Let's do something exciting. Let's get a motivational speaker in. Let's do this. Let's do that. And actually keeping it calm, keeping it steady in that environment is a real skill set as well. So it might be something like that that they would talk to a psychologist about. What's really important is, I think the psychologist in those high performance environments is just part of it. So I think Gareth has Ian Mitchell within England, who's on the pitch in training sessions, is part of every meeting, not some kind of strange thing that's off to the side that we go to when there's a problem. It's just part of what they do. And that's brilliant. For me, that would be amazing to work in, because you're just part of it. You're adding a psychological input, a psychological lens to the conversations, whether that's around tactics, training, messaging to players, what they're going to do in the evenings, all those kind of things. It's just a normal part. Whereas I've seen it before in sport and in football, probably in particular, where we want to do psychology, but we don't quite know how that fits into what we already do. And it ends up being a little bit of a silo, maybe.
Mm. You know, a lot of coaches, managers that I know talk about, well, they all talk about the noise. Mm. You know, the extraneous stuff that comes with elite sport, and specifically football in this case. Mm. How important is it for a team to almost like be in the bubble, isolate themselves from the realities that are around them?
Yeah, I think obviously around social media and things like that, it's very difficult to completely isolate it. But having that ability, especially when you approach the knockouts, I suppose, is to go into that bubble when you're performing. So there's a bubble around that. So what do I need to do? What are my controllable actions? What are the specific things I bring to this team? So still being able to execute those in terms of a performance bubble. And then probably the bubble of the environment, which was maybe what you're referring to a little bit there, Michael, as well. Mm. Yeah. And I listened to Alicia Russo talk about the Lionesses going through the Euros. And she was saying that they'd go in, and the question was kind of like around, did you know what was going on around the country? And I said, well, we got a sense of it when we went to the games. But as soon as we left the games, they were back in the hotel, they were relaxing, they were having coffees. And crucially, the thing that stuck with me was there was no Sky Sports on. So she said they didn't have Sky Sports on. So it went almost like a real buzz and blur of intensity and chaos in the game. So then, right, we're away, we're back in our safe environment, we're having coffees. I think there was sunbathing, all this kind of stuff. But no Sky Sports, not hammering it home. So I think the ability to do that, it's not an easy thing to do, But I think there are certain things around the environment that you can do to lend itself to that. Because we know the players are going to be thinking about it. We know that the motivation is really high, the pressure is really high, the expectation is really high. That's not going to disappear. So we've got to make sure, I think, that environment feels safe, where you can be yourself, where you can be open, where you can talk to someone, where you can get high support whilst also being in this high challenge environment as well.
We've already seen in Qatar the non-football issues, if you want to put it like that, the political elements to both FIFA and the organisation of this particular World Cup. How do you prepare a player for a much bigger role than just his sporting or footballing talent? You know, Harry Kane is almost obliged to be a spokesman for certain causes or to make certain gestures. Gareth Southgate handles it really well. Mm. Is this just now a fact of modern life in elite sport that players are dragged into situations that really they're not prepared for?
Mm. They are dragged into it. But I would argue, from my point of view, the work you do with someone around them as a human being, rather than them as a superstar, centre forward, penalty taker, captain, all that kind of stuff on the pitch. I suppose the role of captain comes into this, but is around them as an individual. What do they stand for? You know, we've seen Harry Kane in recent weeks release a mental health initiative about kind of his mindset and the challenges he's gone through. So you can see that this is someone who's interested in, wants to use his platform to kind of give those messages and communicate with people on a deeper level. So I think it's the work you do with those individuals to develop them to that point that they can cope with it. Of course, to then still be able to go and execute, to go back to those controllables, to make sure that they're performing. That's a real balancing act. But again, I would be keeping them informed, which is maybe something that's difficult to do when it's a kind of ever-moving beast, as we've seen so far. Keep them informed, make sure that they're probably acting in accordance with the team's values and beliefs and their own personal values and beliefs as well. It's a never-ending battle. It's not something you can just, you know, give them a quick pep talk and they'll go and do. I think it's the work you do in preparation for that and the work that the player does and the kind of person they are as well.
Mm. Because we do forget, don't we, Tom, that these are just ordinary guys, really, with an extraordinary talent in a certain area.
Yeah.
You know, are we in danger of forgetting the humanity of international sport?
I think, first of all, I think in my work, whether that's in football or golf or athletics, I've been fortunate to meet and work with some people who have performed at the highest level. And I think we do, like you said there, we kind of forget they are normal people and they do have worries. So if anyone's listening to this and thinking they're superhuman, they're not. They do superhuman things. But when it comes to limiting beliefs, things that hold them back, worries, concerns, it's all in there. They're just able to kind of maybe rationalize that, to spot those unhelpful thoughts and be able to bring it back into a more of a performance way. So into a performance zone. I think, are we losing the humanity? I think sometimes, I think if you look at documentaries that have been out recently or the interviews you do with managers and technical directors, starting to understand the people behind the sport, I think people really engage with that because they understand, okay, what drives this person? What are the setbacks they've had? What are the successes they've had? What can I learn from these people? I think that's really important that kind of content is out there. That's what people engage with, realizing that these people are human beings. And I think we do connect with them. I think over the last couple of tournaments, we probably have connected with our teams more than, I'm talking about England here and probably Wales as well, where we've connected with them. We can look at those players and kind of, I don't know, there's a kind of empathy and trust and vulnerability around it that I think we do engage with and we buy into. So I think the humanity side of our England team, I think is on the rise, I would say.
Sure. You know, you work across sports. Mm. What have you picked up from other sports that you feel is particularly important? You know, I know, for instance, you do a lot of work with St. Helens Rugby League. That's an environment which has always struck me as being really raw, but, you know, almost elemental, really.
Yeah, it's been a great experience working with those guys. So I've worked with them over the last 2 years. And all the things we look at around high performance, I would say they have in terms of, and by that, I mean, they have got a purpose, a clear goal, They've got clear behavioural standards that they hold each other to, importantly. You know, we talk about what are the standards that we walk past. So sometimes we do allow those standards to slip. They're willing to, you know, talk about stuff, as in face challenges head on, not just ignore it and hope they go away. So actually, you know, what do we believe about things? What do we believe about our potential? What are other people saying about us? They've got good people. They're willing to always, you know, go again. They're willing to be open and honest. So whether that's how much I think of you or whether I think you've let us down, you know, they're willing to have those conversations. None of that is around things like facilities or shiny training grounds. I always use that example, and I hope they don't mind me saying, the St. Helens training ground is not the flashiest facility you're going to go to, but it's real, it's grounded, it's honest, and it's where hard work takes place. And I would say it's high performance. Yes, they're very good at what they do as well, so that helps. But in terms of that, they've got the people, they've got the mindset, they've got the kind of purpose as well. So quite often we'll slip into seeing environmental things, like we've got a new piece of kit, or we've got these words on a wall or pictures on a wall, which is all great. But actually, you have to have that fundamental kind of underpinning of those, that trust and that purpose and everything we've talked about, in order for those, you know, environmental tweaks to really carry any weight.
Mm. You mentioned mindset there, Tom. Can you address maybe, you know, an aspiring athlete, footballer, whoever it might be, listening to this? Of the athletes that you've seen and you've worked with, who have the best mindset?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And also, I think we talk about kind of high performance mindset. This gets thrown around a lot. And one thing I would say is that
it's a bit of a cliche.
Well, yes, that was what I was going to say. And like, I've seen players with loads of different personalities and characters. So introverts, extroverts, impatient, patient, you know, mavericks versus someone who needs loads of instruction and conformity. I've seen a range of characters thrive in elite sport. So first of all, that kind of myth of personality, sometimes I think that needs challenging, especially around team sports. And then the mindset for you to do your job, or for me to do my job, like if we were footballers, as well, maybe we wish we were, those mindsets might be different.
That's usually a starting point.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Failed players. But that mindset might be different. Like, what zone do I need to be in order to perform at my best? So anyone listening, I'd be saying, what are you like at your best? Okay, start to map that out. What does that look like? What are the beliefs and the attitudes and the feelings that underpin that? And what's the thought processes that underpin that? And then flip it and go, what are we like when we're not at our best? Because we all have those days. Like these people that we're talking about in the World Cup all have those days. What are we like when we're having an off day? What does that look like and feel like? And what's our thought process around that? And start to build a bit of a framework for where you are and where you think you are at your best, and maybe on those off days as well. And then it's about finding ways to be in that positive state more often, and being able to not be perfect, because you're not going to be 100% all the time. But if we're at 50%, can we get to 60 or 65 and help our team even more so? So I think dispelling the myth of personality as something you've either got or you haven't, and being able to build that framework of what it looks like for you. Do I need to be calm? Do I need to be really up for it? Because you do see players where they're so pumped up that they then can't perform. You know, they can't execute their normal, controllable actions that they would always go back to. So it's, don't think of it as something that is, you know, you've either got or you haven't, or it's some kind of like magical golden nugget that we need. It's something to work on. It's something to proactively work on, to build those skills around it, which everyone can do, regardless of whether you're a football player or if you're working in business or in schools or whatever.
Yeah, you know, I know, you know, we talked about cliches just a couple of minutes ago. You know, one of the cliches I hate, to be honest, is, oh, he writes his own scripts. But there are certain players that applies to, you know, Gareth Bale being one. Is there anything in these guys, their psychological approach? Is it sort of, well, you know, I'm born to do this, so therefore I am going to excel at it? What, if you take a Bale or any other examples that you could give us, they basically shape occasions by almost a force of nature.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's probably you build that belief as well. So probably from a young age, like, I impact big games, I can make the difference, you know, things like that. And then obviously you build that evidence mentally when you go out and do that in the Champions League final or in the World Cup or whatever it might be. You know, you look at someone like Mbappe, he's probably done that a little bit as well, from when he was 19 in the last World Cup. So I think you do build that expectation. We talk about kind of self-talk and you know, becoming what, if you don't know where you want to go, then how are you going to get there? So building this belief and this expectation around yourself. And I think probably the other thing that the best players do on just a psychological level is, so our brains are designed to scan for threats. So we see things that can cause us danger, cause us harm. And we do that in modern day as well. So we start to think, oh, what if this happens? What if that happens? Oh, Brazil are really good, aren't they? You know, our brains work really fast. So we almost don't have time to stop ourselves doing that. So we're looking for threats. You'll see, I don't know, maybe in the past taking penalties, we'll rush them because we just want to avoid them. We want to get them done. So that's a threat mindset. Whereas what those guys have probably learned and built and probably maybe quite naturally into that opportunity mindset. So then they know they're in a state where they've got an opportunity to do something. And it's not a case of having an absence of thought or an absence of emotion and just doing it. You know, I hear people say, oh, just trust yourself, just go for it. Quite often, they'll still have those kind of thoughts, but they're able to acknowledge them and rationalize them into that state of opportunity. So opportunity versus threat, you know, these guys that you mentioned, I'm sure they have a sense of opportunity. They have a sense for the fairy tale, for the story that it's never, you know, it's never over. And I think that's a combination of that belief, but also that ability to see the opportunity within an environment that is, if you think about professional football and knockout football, it's full of threats. So it's a threat environment, but being able to see those opportunities and manage yourself during that time.
What are the specific pressures of knockout football? You know, we're just about to enter that phase in this World Cup. Mm. And, you know, whenever one thinks about knockout football in a World Cup context, you always think about penalties, you know, Baggio and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Again, how can you prepare someone for that type of pressure?
Mm. I think if you look at penalties, almost like a sport within itself, I guess, and something that we've obviously talked about a lot as a nation, and we've had a lot of baggage and a lot of experience. What teams are doing now, and we've seen it in the Premier League as well, and you know that there's more attention paid to the psychology of penalties. So whether that's the individual in terms of their own preparation, their own routine. So you might see Harry Kane, you'll see him taking a big breath before he takes his penalty. Even against Iran in our first group game, you saw their player take a long time before he took that penalty kick. So we all have our own routines. Alan Shearer used to turn his back, which you wouldn't advise anyone else to do. But if you're Alan Shearer, you can kind of do what you want when it comes to penalties. So I think there's been more focus on the mental side of building a routine and having something you can anchor to and go back to under pressure. We've not been perfect at that, of course, and it doesn't take away from the fact that you're still going to miss at times. But there has been more of a focus on the psychology of penalties and the preparation of penalties in terms of the psychology of execution. And I think in the past, we've maybe been guilty of just going, oh, let's just see what happens. You know, let's just, we've got good players. Let's hope they get us through. You know, there's a really interesting piece of research, which I'm sure you've probably seen, where a Norwegian psychologist, Geir Jorde, he categorized every penalty taken in major tournaments. And we were top of all these lists and leagues that you didn't want to be top by. You know, we'd react to the referee's whistle like it was a starting gun at 100 meters. We turn our backs the most. You know, Jamie Carragher once took a penalty before the ref blew his whistle and had to retake it, you know, because he just, and to, yeah, that. So to me, that's a case of the brain, just get out of here. That's a threat state. So I think there's been more work done on that. I think from our perspective, in terms of England, we've won penalty shootouts now. We got that off our back against Colombia 4 years ago, or whatever it is now. So we've been able to do that. We've been able to see some evidence. And then I think it's an individual thing. You know, it is, again, that threat and opportunity that we come back to. But being able to work on that, I've read this week that maybe this was on your podcast as well, but they've been practicing without keepers, because the keepers can obviously subconsciously start to learn where they're going to go, their own teammate keepers. So they've been practicing without keepers and things like that. So starting just to incorporate psychology within that practice has been a big part for the penalties. And then if you look at the knockout phases as well, I think one thing that jumped out for me was, it doesn't always have to be perfect. You know, I think sometimes we can, you know, you might scrape through 1-0. It's about getting through, about building that momentum. We've seen in other sports where we might play our final in the semi-final. I'm thinking of the Rugby World Cup, maybe. That was kind of thrown at the rugby team against the All Blacks because they gave everything in that. So it's about building that momentum as well. It doesn't have to be perfect. You know, in 2014, Germany, I think, scraped through in their first knockout phase. And there was an interview afterwards, and they're saying, well, that wasn't very good, was it? It was Mertesacker. And he said, whatever, we're in the last eight. That was his reply. And that shows that mindset. The media's attacking us, but actually we've got this bubble. We've done our job. So it doesn't have to be Perfect. I'm sure you watched The Last Dance, right? So about with the Chicago Bulls, and there's a clip in that. I can't remember what phase it is during the end of season, the finals, but it's Reggie Miller. And he says, they'd obviously got beaten by the Bulls. And he said, we were the better team, but championship experience and DNA rose to the top. He said, I'm convinced we were the better team. So it's not always the best team that goes through.
As a final point, if I could, Tom, it's probably an unfair question, but I'll ask it anyway. If there is one player at this World Cup that you could work with, who would that be?
That's a great question. I think two that spring to mind. So the first one, which might be a bit of a cop-out maybe, but would be Messi, just because of the expectation that has been on his shoulders for a long period of time. So this is probably his last World Cup, isn't it? Being able to navigate that with a highly talented team, with an opportunity to do it, how you go about that and manage yourself through that would be really rewarding. And the other one from England would probably be Marcus Rashford. I think someone who's given a lot to our country, but also been through quite a lot in terms of form, in terms of the context of football. So form at Manchester United, coming off the back of the Euros, he's made a late run into the England team, probably has the opportunity to have a real impact. So he would be another one, because I think he's a really interesting character who's obviously brought a lot to the country on and off the field.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time and your insight, and all the best with whatever you get up to next.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
I thought that was interesting, Johnny, to hear such an unsolicited restatement of Gareth Southgate's qualities by Tom. We've talked about the culture of criticism. Do you think, as far as England is concerned, and I know you'll partially be speaking as a Scotsman here, but are too many conditioned to negativity as far as the England team's concerned?
You mean too many of in our business, Mike?
In our business or the wider fan base?
Yeah, I mean, it strikes you on social media during any game how there's a certain lobby that's determined to jump very quickly on a bad 20 minutes, and Southgate and the handbrake comes up quite a lot. And even in the aftermath of the Wales game, there was another lobby that, instead of, I guess, praising him for his use of Rashford and Foden and for making a good tactical switch at half-time, there was another lot that wanted to see that as, oh, that's proof he's a bad manager because he got it wrong for the first half. It was only the second half when he put them in the right positions that things were good. And I found that interview with Tom fascinating, because not least because he worked with Belgium during the 2018 World Cup, when they were a very happy camp and came very close to winning it. And we see what's happening with the Belgian squad now, when they're in a very different position as a group of people. And I don't know who they've got helping them, but maybe they could do with Tom. And what he was saying about Gareth, I guess, echoes what we've been trying to talk about, which is that ability to create a culture, to create a unity of purpose that outlasts the noise around it and the negativity that you're talking about. And interesting to hear him say that, I guess, in effect, it's easier said than done, that there's some quite subtle and difficult work goes on from people like Gareth to create these situations, these conditions.
I was also quite struck by Tom's references to the often overlooked fact that these players face the human challenges that we all face. Now, Paul, you're working with Kevin Sinfield in what is an absolutely inspirational cause. Has that affected you? And with all your football experience as well, bring that in if you could. But it gets to the heart of what sport is. It's people sometimes conquering themselves. There's a great deal of, there are so many human qualities that we get through sport. Do you see that?
I do. The older I've got and the more time I've spent in this industry, the more I've become interested in what I'd call the human element. The things that you can't see, the thing that doesn't show up on a team sheet or a formation or an expected goals analysis or any other scientific rationale for analysing sport, and to see it from trying to see it from the performer's perspective most of the time is, I think, is very enlightening. When I was writing the book with Sir Alex Ferguson, he talked to me about players, and I began to understand players and what they were living and going through in a way that I hadn't previously, because, you know, there's a tendency to look at them as just performers on a stage out there. They're ciphers, really, you know. And then when you start thinking about their lives and what they're going through and what might affect them in their performances, it becomes much more interesting. And the work with Kevin Simfield, particularly last week, taught me a lot about captaincy and leadership and bringing people together in a cause and developing, Tom used this phrase in the interview, common purpose. As John said, that's not easy to do. People think it's easy, but it's not. You know, to get 24 people to pull together, to help each other, to cover each other, to support each other, and to actually achieve things and win things and come out of it feeling vindicated, it's an immensely difficult process, but it starts with the human element, not with the science, I think.
Well, we've now got, Johnny, the element of jeopardy coming into play. Is that, in your view, the essence of tournament football?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we've seen Argentina on this ride where every game's had jeopardy, and England haven't been in that position, but they're now entering that position. And, you know, another fascinating element of that interview that you did with Tom was him talking about how you move, or there's a danger moving from the opportunity mindset to the threat mindset, because knockout football's all about threats. It's all about what happens if we slip up, concede a goal, go behind, lose on penalties. And it's about trying to maintain that sort of sense of freedom and opportunity that you had in the group stages while being cognizant of the stakes, I suppose. Another thing that struck me that Tom said was, you know, you don't have to be perfect, and you need to get that in your mind as a team. You don't have to be perfect. It's about progressing. It's not about giving the perfect performance. And if I think back to how Gareth has navigated previous tournaments, the Colombia game, which was a great release for the nation, I suppose, because they won on penalties, that was not a perfect performance at all. You know, England were in control of that game and then struggled a bit and got worn down by sort of Colombian aggression and conceded a silly late goal. And yet they mentally recovered to win on penalties. That's where England might find themselves against a Senegal team that shouldn't be underestimated. It's not going to be a breeze. It's not going to be a perfect day. And it's about resilience and reacting to situations as they come in the game.
Yeah, Senegal, the first African team to face England in the World Cup since Cameroon in 1990, Paul. I'm interested in motivational areas or trigger points or even rallying points. There are probably two as far as Senegal's concerned. The first being, you know, they won the AFCON title in February. But secondly, the loss of Sadio Mane, perversely, has that given them that common purpose that Johnny talked about?
Well, it doesn't seem to have harmed them much. I mean, they beat Ecuador and Qatar and then lost 2-0 to the Netherlands. The fact that they are champions of Africa, I think, gives them a kind of standard-bearing quality. You know, they know how good they are. They're not trying to find out whether they're a good side. They know they are. And it was interesting. I mean, 2018, no African country reached the knockout stages. That was the first time that had happened for 36 years. So they are standard bearers for African football as well. And, you know, they'll really fancy the idea of the World Cup win of a lifetime in the second round, because England are really sitting there as a target for them, aren't they? And they couldn't possibly have a greater motivation than to knock out the Premier League's team, you know, the Premier League stars. They'll be a handful. They're physical, they're experienced, they're good. They don't have Mane, as you said, but they have some serious players, including Moses Cachedo from Brighton.
Yeah, we'll go into the private grief area of that in a second, Paul, if we could, because, you know, I suppose we can go into it now, if you like, because obviously if you look at that group, there are players playing for a move. Ismaila Sarr, I'm quite intrigued by Illiman Ndiaye at Sheffield United. They're players who are almost quite literally playing for their future, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of them have got really good futures already, of course. You know, do you remember those days decades ago when it was a question of kind of spotting an African player with potential and they might end up at European club. It's not really like that anymore, is it? The scouting is industrialized. The intelligence network works so well. What we're really talking about, I suppose, Mike, is players going up the grades from mid-ranking clubs to top clubs, you know, top six clubs. That's always the target, isn't it, for the wages and the opportunities that brings. But yeah, certainly this team is you know, bristling with players, upwardly mobile players, I'd say.
Yeah. If we're looking at weaknesses, Johnny, would they come in midfield where, you know, they have to do without Idrissa Gueye, who's suspended? You know, I'll put my hands up here. I'd even forgotten that Pape Matar-Sarr even plays for Spurs, or doesn't play, as the case may be. It looks like he might come in. Does that give England their opportunity?
I think there is an opportunity in midfield. I mean, Sarr's a very young player, talented, but not a lot of experience. I mean, another player that fascinates me is Palace Mendy, who barely has played for Leicester over the last two or three years, but is actually a very resilient little character who's had terrible injuries and come back from there. And is a good player, but I don't think anyone is quite of the level of Ghana Gueye when it comes to ball recoveries and defending in midfield. And that will be an issue for them against Jude Bellingham in particular, but also Harry Kane dropping deep. And he's been at his best in this tournament in the kind of Sheringham role rather than the Shearer role. So there is an opportunity there for England. But, you know, there are players that you've mentioned as well, like Ismail Assar and Ilian Ndeng, who are going to be difficult to handle going forward. And I don't think anyone's got at England's defence yet, really. So it doesn't strike me that it's going to be a particularly easy game from an England point of view. But they should be able to exploit strength if all goes well in certain areas to win it. Just not comfortably, in my opinion.
Let's look at some of the other last 16 games. The Netherlands, they've got USA on Saturday, Paul. Is this, do you think, Louis van Gaal's last hurrah? And should we be concentrating more on his influence as a coach of really global stature?
Yeah, it's interesting. Somebody made the point to me last night that there aren't many coaches, managers at this World Cup who were top-level managers. You know, there's Hansi Flick, club managers, I should say, Luis Enrique, and van Gaal is very much on that list. You know, international coaches tend to be people not from the very top of the club game for all sorts of reasons we could spend ages discussing. But van Gaal is one of the few people that bestrides the two disciplines, club and international football, and he's been successful in both. I guess whether it's his last hurrah would depend on his health, wouldn't it, above all. I hear complaining from the Netherlands end about his style of play, as there was at Manchester United when he turned them into a slightly slow kind of clockwork team, didn't he? he went sideways and backwards relentlessly across the Old Trafford pitch and had people yawning quite a lot, which is not to disrespect him entirely, because he's got an amazing CV. But you would think ultimately that the Netherlands would want a younger coach who's probably more in tune with the way the world game is going at some point, but they'll be pretty happy to have him now, I'm sure of that.
What about the USA, Johnny? I know you've been around their camp. They strike me as an extremely likeable group. I thought the way Tyler Adams dealt with the political dimension of that Iran game was absolutely superb. What about them as a working outfit, if you like? Are they good enough to beat the Netherlands?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks to Paul there, because if I have to write about Van Gaal's Holland, then he's given me Clockwork Orange as an intro line.
This is how magic happens.
I'll send you the invoice, Johnny.
Yeah. I'll pay anything for an intro. We all would, wouldn't we? but yeah, I mean, with the USA, you're right. I spent some time with Tyler Adams at a community event about a month before the World Cup, and what you see is a very principled and intelligent young man, and that seems to be true of a lot of the other American players. They put a lot into education in American sport, as we know, and Tyler was telling me that he's still doing a college degree that's being funded by New York Red Bulls, because it's a condition of MLS clubs now that when they take young players, they pay for their entire college education for the rest of their lives, basically. So that Tyler's still cashing in on that. But the USA players, I mean, Anthony Robinson, who we both know, Mike, and I know you know his father, was an incredibly touching scenes with the way he was comforting the Iran players at the end. And I think as a group, the USA have been really impressive from that mental perspective, because it was a disappointment in their first game against Wales. They put themselves in a really tight spot, actually, and were the stronger team against England, really, let's be honest. And then to come through that emotional game against Iran the way they did was enormously impressive. And they've been outstanding in this tournament. They lack a brilliant striker, but my goodness, they're good in midfield. And the likes of Dest and Robinson are incredible athletes at the back.
Mm. Yeah, France, yeah, the holders, they play Poland on Sunday, Paul. With qualification secured, did they effectively take the day off against Tunisia? They lost 1-0 and it was ultimately irrelevant, thankfully. But you know, how fair is it to the other people in the group that you make 9 changes and frankly don't turn up?
Yeah, that did make me uncomfortable, I must admit. It was like one of those late stage Champions League games, wasn't it, where the you know, the second team gets a run out when the team's already qualified. It looked wrong to me. I can understand why he did it. He's only thinking about his own team, but it didn't really help the competition in many ways. And, you know, they struggled as a consequence. I mean, I've only seen 4 teams that I think can win this World Cup, which are Brazil, Spain, France and England. I can't really see beyond any of those. I don't know whether you two guys can, but, and France defending champions, no country's defended a title since what, 62, I think, is that right? It's a notoriously hard thing to win twice in a row. France have the ability, they have the manager, they have the players. But do they have the chemistry? So often with France, it tends to come back to chemistry, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think also that they will ultimately miss N'Golo Kanté. Do you agree with that, Johnny?
I'm not sure, actually. I mean, no one's a bigger Kanté fan than me. And of course, the Kanté of 4 years ago would be send this French team to another level. But the Kanté of now is diminished as an athlete. And I think Tchouaméni's had a really good tournament. I think he's such a fine player. And they haven't even used Camavinga. I know Camavinga played yesterday in the sort of dead rubber, but they haven't used him yet in a kind of serious game. And he's got talent to burn. So I don't necessarily see that as the weak spot. I think the weakness might lie in the fullback areas. And Rabiot has never convinced me at all as a footballer. It's not a perfect French team. But I would agree with Paul that it's the 4 he mentioned, and maybe Argentina after seeing how the momentum's building with them. Very flawed team, but there's a bit of something special going on with them.
The support they're receiving is amazing, isn't it, Paul? Yeah, I suppose we must call them Messi Incorporated now, mustn't we? They're faced with the ultimate underdog here, aren't they? Australia. Their qualification for the last 16 is a signature achievement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think that with the USA and Australia, you're really seeing, how can I say this without sounding patronising, the kind of the new world in football is the new world on the rise. Australia, there are an awful lot of big sports in Australia, so football is really up against it and trying to gain a foothold in Australia. I remember in covering the 1994 World Cup in the USA and people saying that there was no way on earth that football would ever replace the big 3 sports in America. It would just be a sort of little token fringe sport in the United States. And I think that's changing. I think now you would say that football is becoming, you know, a seriously mainstream sport in the American culture. Will it become so in Australia? Again, stiff competition, but reaching the last 16 of this competition would certainly help.
Yeah, I can remember watching 93 with 93,000 people at Pasadena. You know, there was a huge groundswell. You know, probably took a while to build, didn't it? When you think about Argentina, you do think about Messi, Johnny. Can you give us an insight into the hype that is around him at this tournament, given that even my wife said to me yesterday, who doesn't really understand football, God bless her, oh, this is Messi's last World Cup, isn't it? Now, that to me was the ultimate cut-through moment.
Yeah, it is one of the obsessions of the tournament, and it goes beyond the Argentina camp. There are a lot of, as we've sort of all discussed about Qatar now, it's a place that's essentially full of migrants, 90% of the population, and these are a lot from South Asia, and Messi seems to be have a huge following in that part of the world and among, you know, football fans internationally. So there's a lot of local support for him. It strikes me as well how the Argentina players keep talking about Messi and keep talking about the burden they feel almost to do it for Messi. And I have no insight into Messi as a character, sadly. I've never had the chance to speak to him, and I would love to. So I don't quite, I don't know his psychology. I can watch, I can see it from afar, but he does seem to have this incredible capacity to be at the center of all this, handle it, and stay in his bubble. We've been talking about bubbles. There's a certain Messi bubble that you see him playing in the pitch. And I felt, funnily enough, I felt he was brilliant in 2014. I felt he was very good in a ridiculously dysfunctional Argentina team in 2018. And he's been very, very good here. So the idea that Messi's never brought it to tournaments is nonsense. And I think he's doing all he can. I think he's blotting out this noise incredibly. It's more, it's probably whether the rest of the Argentines can handle the emotion of the situation rather than whether he can handle it.
Mm. Yeah, there's no more emotional camp pull than a Brazilian camp at a World Cup, which is absolutely manic on a quiet day. Half-fit Neymar, they've got their final group game against Cameroon on Friday. Is this Brazilian team one to enter legend?
I can't really see what they're lacking. I can't see a significant hole in the team, you know, a defensive vulnerability or a lack of goals or a lack of midfield power and control. They have, to me, they have the best balance of attributes of any team that we've seen so far. And it's a testament to that, really, that, you know, Neymar can drop out with an injury and the team carries on and looks just as good, pretty much. It may lack the elaboration that Neymar would bring to it, but it functions just as well without him because there are so many good attacking players in there. And I spotted yesterday that 11 of the Brazil squad play in the Premier League, which is a remarkable statistic when you think about it. I mean, sometimes they look like a Premier League team. You could get a whole 11 of Premier League players out on the pitch for them. And that's an extraordinary comment on the power of the Premier League. And thankfully, the Premier League isn't ruining these players because 20 years ago, it probably would have done.
Yeah. Well, you know, you're out there, Johnny. What's the mood music around that Brazilian camp?
Yeah, I've seen it at other tournaments. They have a sense of this being their tournament and their own destiny being here. But they do seem to be more of a unit than possibly before. In 2014, I remember the Neymar mania was just ludicrous. And 2018, there was that instability that we saw. There were lurches in performance. This seems to be a better group, a tighter group. And funnily enough, for me, the player that set the tone for them has been Thiago Silva. It's not been any of the... I mean, Casemiro has been great as well. But it's in a World Cup where we've been talking about, you know, serenity and control and shutting out what's around. I mean, nobody does it better than that guy. At an age where we're pensioning off Ronaldo and, you know, 4 years older than, let's say, a fading athlete like Gareth Bale. I don't know how Thiago does it. I think he'll go down as one of the greatest players of all time, frankly, and we should appreciate him. But it's control. That's what I've seen from Brazil so far. There's been a control about them in both of their games that's ominous for the rest of the tournament.
Yeah, well, we've been talking about winners, but for me, the worst performing team in this World Cup isn't Qatar or Denmark, Belgium, or even Wales. It's FIFA. Corporate greed and political ambition explains why next time, in 2026, we'll have a ludicrously loaded 48-team tournament. In that tawdry spirit, we now hear suggestions that penalty shootouts, offering a bonus point in the event of a draw in the group phase, should be introduced. Now, the qualification process from three match groups is far from perfect, but the last thing football needs is more crass Americanization. I hope you agree. All that remains is to thank Tom Young for his observations, and of course to reinforce my gratitude to Paul and Johnny for their insights. Enjoy sudden death football, everyone, before they work out a way to ruin it.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.